Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Museum Talk. I'm here with Renee.
Yeah, I haven't been on Museum Talk for a while, so I'm excited to be here.
It's been a while. Yeah, I was gone last week, but it's been a while for sure.
Well, yeah, but we're glad to be here live again. We've got a really great show today. So
yeah, we have a good show lined up and a special guest. Nan Prince is here with us from Mississippi, and we'll give you a more formal introduction in a few. But first, we're going to talk about an article that I found browsing around last night. That's, you know, we've talked about a lot of the, museum objects that have been, like, reclaimed by, you know, the original countries and things like that they came from. This one is a tricky one, though. Like, the more, when I read the article, it really is a hard one. It's the Rosetta Stone, and you're in collections, Nan, so you'll have some insight on this. So Egypt is calling, and they have a petition, like a formal petition. They're calling on the British Museum to return the Rosetta Stone, which, you know, really makes total sense, because when you think about the Rosetta Stone, you think about Egypt. You know, you don't think about Britain history. But the way that it was acquired was so strange, and you know, in a legal battle, I don't know. I think that, you know, that's just too crazy to even think about, really, like how that would work. I don't see how anyone could win that. But in case you don't know, so it was actually acquired by the British from the French. And I think it was the 1700s.
1801.
Was it 18? Did you read this? What are you talking about?
I do my homework. But I don't, you know, and it is interesting. And it's also, I mean, the British Museum being part of this story makes it even more interesting, because the British Museum, no one knows if they've repatriated anything in their collections. That's not something they've been transparent about. And they've been, they have some pretty high profile things in their collections that have been called for repatriation for years and years, the Parthenon, the Elgin marbles in particular. But I think you're right, Scotty, just the whole sort of origin story of how the British got it in the first place is, you know, being in a fight with France, which they were always in fights with France.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's always confusion with that in the first place. But then also the fact that the person in Egypt who helped sign the treaty that signed over some of these artifacts, not just the Rosetta Stone, but several others, was an Ottoman ruler. So not actually an Egyptian ruler.
Yeah.
But the Ottoman Empire was over Egypt at the time. And it wasn't in a war situation that all of this happened. So it's a tricky one.
Well, and so it was unearthed in 1799.
Yes.
By the French under Napoleon's rule. And so that's kind of how they ended up with it. And then, you know, and the treaty between France and England is how it got into British hands, you know, custody. And so now it's embarking on the 200th anniversary of its translation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a super important year for it. And I guess it was translated under, you know,
under the French, I think.
Yeah,
or certainly by a French scholar.
Yeah. And so from what I read, the British Museum, you know, which is now Britain's largest museum. Which museum is it? I read this, I promise.
It's the British Museum.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But it's the largest museum, and their stance is like it's such an important object for them. They feel that it would be very detrimental for them to lose it. Which I understand.
Well, and I feel like they're not necessarily saying that out loud. I feel like that's what's being said between the lines,
yeah.
But they're more like, we are the best keeper of such artifacts. And that's always a tricky argument, because there's a lot of colonialism and other issues that come into play sometimes with that. But Nan, as someone who's from a collections perspective, what are your thoughts on this? And I'm sure it's, I don't know if it's something that ever has come up within your realm.
Well, definitely repatriation has been a big issue for so many museums in the States. I know we're dealing with it with our archaeology collection. And the Rosetta Stone, that's a key to so much of our understanding of Egypt and Egyptology. So it's a tough call. I mean, it is a premier artifact for the British Museum. I know they're going to hate to lose it, but it's what they're dealing with is certainly nothing new to many museums here and in the States. And of course, they've been dealing with their own issues for years. So it's a conundrum for sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
the article did talk about some of the museums who've recently returned artifacts. For instance, the Met had returned some artifacts that I think that it turned out they'd been illegally smuggled. And I think they left their country of origin during the Nazi occupation or something like that. So there was some connection, some very, very dodgy connections there. Not necessarily from the Met standpoint per se, but just the original side of it. But yeah, it's a tricky situation. But the one thing that I thought was interesting in the article that I hadn't realized is that there were multiple versions of the translated decree. The Rosetta Stone is the most famous, but that there are other versions of it, which I didn't ever realize. Even though I'm an archaeologist by trade, ultimately not Egyptologist, but I just didn't realize that the Rosetta Stone wasn't completely unique.
I think it was just the primary source to unlocking that, translation of hieroglyphics, which is so crazy because it makes it so much more a part of Egypt's history than Britain. And so you can kind of see, I can just see like the argument for it being returned. But, there are some scholars, I think he was a CEO of a website or an organization called Past Preserves. It's an online academic forum, and he's like, talking about how the British Museum's lack of transparency kind of lends to the motives for them are what you said. They're not saying it out loud, but it is like money and visitation and the popularity of their museum.
I understand. I mean, all museums are reliant on those factors, but I've been to the British Museum multiple times, and there's so much there obviously there's some amazing stuff from other countries there, but there's some amazing stuff from Britain there that are really highly significant and have stories that deserve to be told more widely. And it's not a black and white answer necessarily, but it is coming up more and more. And like you said, Nan, it's not new to museums, but it feels like it's coming more and more into the public consciousness in the last several years.
Well, and another thing worth noting is that also the Egyptian stance is that it kind of the way where it is and how it got there is, kind of makes it a symbol of violence against the Middle East. So that just opens up a whole nother discussion. So should we take a vote? I'm just kidding. I'll keep my opinion to myself, but that's definitely a hard one, and who knows how that's going to end.
I would say, based on how the Elgin Marbles have ended, that that it'll certainly be a long and drawn out process. It won't end quickly.
Well, and we did talk about those marbles several months ago, but did you know that because of the two museums kind of battling, another museum took the opportunity and made digital, 3D prints of them.
Yeah.
So they have replicas on display. They're well, if you're not doing anything, we're going to do this.
Yeah. Was that? Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. All right. So that's our museum article for the day. We'll go ahead and get started with the interview. So as we said, we have Nan Prince here, and you have a long title like me. So You're the director of collections for the Museum Division of the Mississippi Department of Archives and History.
Yes, long title.
Yeah, well, yours might be longer, but mine's up there. So just to start, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience and how you got to the MDAH.
Okay, well, I am a native Mississippian. I grew up in a small town called Aberdeen in the northeast part of the state and started working for the museums at Ole Miss when I was in college. And I worked all through undergraduate and graduate school there and really got on-the-job training for my career working as a student in the university museums. And then spent some time in Kansas and New Orleans and moved to Jackson in 2003 to work for the Department of Archives and History. And started first at the Old Capitol Museum, which at the time was serving as the State History Museum. And then a few years ago, we moved into our new facility, which houses the two Mississippi museums. And so I've been here in this capacity of director of collections for a little over 5 years now. So we have approximately about 25,000 objects in the collection, and the museum division collects the 3D artifacts for the Department of Archives and History. We also have our archives and record services, which collects our paper items, photographs, AV materials, and then we have a separate archaeology collection as well.
Wow, that's awesome. That's a lot of collections.
Yeah, I mean, on the scale of collections, how many objects approximately are we talking about?
In my collection, yes, in the museum division, about 25,000, which includes, we also maintain the collection for the Adora Welty House. She was a local Pulitzer Prize winning author here. She had over 5,000 books alone in her collection. So,
well, that's what I was wondering, is if beyond that 25,000, you counted other things that you all sort of preserved and took care of. And 5,000 books alone, that's sounds like bliss to me. That sounds awesome.
Well, she had them all over the house.
So outside of you, how many other staff members do you have in your department just for your collection?
Gosh, in the department itself, we have probably about 100 to 130 or so.
Wow.
And that's a guess, I should have counted before I started, but that's the entire department. We also have our Historic Preservation Division and out-of-town sites as well included in that. Within our collections section, for our historic objects collection, we have three staff members on the collection section, and we also have a conservator on staff as well as an exhibit staff within our department. So we do all of our in-house exhibits here.
Yeah, awesome. That's really cool. So I'm actually going to blurt in and take Renee's turn on a question just because you already mentioned it. And so, you know, I was reading up and I read the two Mississippi museums and I was like, wait, why aren't they more specific? Why are they just calling it the two Mississippi museums? And then finally I got it. It's like, okay, like two Mississippi, like one Mississippi, two Mississippi, a play on that. And it's two museums in one location. Correct.
Yeah, well, the two Mississippi museums is exactly what it is. It's two museums under one roof. And we opened in 2017, December, for our state's bicentennial. And the two museums are actually the Museum of Mississippi History, which serves as the State History Museum, and the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum. So the Civil Rights Museum is on one side, the History Museum on one side, and we share within the building an auditorium, the temporary exhibit gallery space, classroom, as well as we have two floors of state-of-the-art collection storage within the facility as well. So that's where our staff is based too.
And 2017, that's a young museum.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
It is.
We opened
it
in 2014, and, you know, it's flown by, so I can only imagine, like, it's still got to be new for you. Yeah, and that's got to be, like, a really cool, like, that's pretty unique for two museums like that, I feel.
And do you find that there's a lot of collaboration because of that between the two, or do they still sort of create their own programming and sort of do their own thing, or do they collaborate together?
Collaborate together well. The staff is one staff for both museums, and we have a departmental programming staff that does the programming for the whole department. So we vary programs that touch on all aspects of Mississippi history. So the two museums, I think, really do complement each other very well. So you get in the History Museum an overview of Mississippi history, and then you pull out the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Museum, obviously. But it's, you know, Mississippi was ground zero for the Civil Rights Movement. Yeah. So we really can go in depth into those years and discuss that history.
Well, and again, we always end up saying this, but we need a road trip to come visit for sure.
Well, and before we talk about the special exhibit you have right now, just let's talk a little bit more about some of the objects in the collection. And, you know, as your role as the director, what's the most interesting or unusual object you've dealt with there that has like a cool story that you could tell us about?
There are so many wonderful objects. It's
like asking for your favorite child.
Probably one of my favorites is it's a rocking chair that was made by a man named William Duffner. He was a Union soldier who fought in the Battle of Port Gibson, which is part of the Vicksburg campaign, and during the Civil War. And years after the war, he wrote the postmaster in Port Gibson and said, "Is there anybody there who can draw me a map of the battle?" And so the postmaster contacted a man named A.K. Schaefer, who was a Confederate soldier. And his house, the Schaefer house, was on the grounds right around where the Battle of Port Gibson was fought. So Schaefer wrote to Duffner, and it started just a lifelong correspondence and friendship between the two men. They would visit each other. And years later, Duffner made A.K. Schaefer this rocking chair, and it has the entire Battle of Port Gibson painted on it. And
holy
he
cow.
Sent the rocking chair to him, and then the Schaefer family donated it to us a few years ago. But it's just such a great post-Civil War reconciliation artifact, and we have it on display now in the History Museum.
I think that's something that people don't really think about with museums sometimes, is how many objects within our collections aren't objects that are necessarily about from an important or not important, a well-known person or directly connected to a well-known thing. But so many of them are these personal stories, which makes to me are the most interesting. Those stories, like you said, this lifelong correspondence between two soldiers from opposite sides of the battlefield in the Civil War. That sounds amazing. I'd like to see a picture of that.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
I'll show it to you when you come visit.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, I mean, like you were saying, the small stories or the unknown stories are the ones that really, stand out to me a bit more typically. So, yeah.
And do you have anything in the collections that's just really odd? We're big fans of oddities and curiosities.
We do have, you know, of course, probably one of our oddest things. We have a lot of hair jewelry and hair wreaths from, you know, the Victorian era, when that was just the rave, was to make everything out of hair. So we have some of the hair jewelry on display and some neat hair wreaths too. So that's probably some of the oddest kind of, you look at it and like, ugh. What is this?
I feel like the Victorians were a bit gruesome, really. But I saw my first hair wreath actually when we went to the Reese Museum.
Same here. I was going to say
I mean, I'd heard of hair rings and stuff, and I like locks of hair and lockets and that kind of thing, but I'd never heard of a hair wreath. And then when the collections person there was showing us a behind-the-scenes tour and she showed me that, I was just like, I don't even know how to react to this.
I really...
Feels like it's the kind of thing that would end up in a horror movie, to be honest.
I don't know. I mean, they are, I'll admit, it is kind of weird and creepy, but at the same time, they were pretty. And, they're really a neat kind of thing.
And it's just hair, but it still has, I don't know, there's just something, it feels like there's some weird power attached to that, too.
Well, I think that may be.
And that's probably why they did it.
That's what I was going to say. That's probably why.
Not like magical power, but just like this memory power and emotion and all of those things. So.
But I'd never seen them before either. And one of our local college close in Johnson City has a really nice art museum. And they had some in their collection. And I was like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So we recently just met in Arkansas at SCMC, and so that was when, like,
October,
a month and a half ago or something. And I think that was the first time we met. My memory's bad, but I definitely remember that this time. So we realized pretty quick. I think you brought it up, the connection with Marty Stewart, who is a Mississippi native. And right now, you all are hosting an exhibit called The World of Marty Stewart. Can you tell us a bit about that exhibit?
Absolutely. Well, Marty Stewart, as probably most of your listeners know, is a country music artist born in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And he started as a young child playing music and left home and joined Lester Flatt's Traveling Bluegrass Band at the age of 13. So he's been playing in music his entire life and amassing this wonderful collection of country music memorabilia as well. And so the world of Marty Stewart just tracks his life. It starts out with his birth and early childhood in Philadelphia and goes on through his early days in Nashville with playing with Lester Flatt. And then after that, joining Johnny Cash's band and then striking out on his own. And concludes with The Pilgrim, which was his big concept album. And then also what he's doing today, which is playing with his band, Marty Stewart and the Fabulous Superlatives. So they're still playing everywhere today. So the exhibit tracks through the artifacts that he saved and the wonderful collection that he has, tracks his life and his music and his influences.
Yeah, I mean, that's really one of my favorite things about Marty Stewart is that how much of a fan he is of, you know, being as high profile a country and bluegrass artist that he is, he still has a passion, you know, for, you know, just that music and other practitioners and people coming before him. And, you know, we had his photography exhibit a couple of years ago. And, you know, that was when we installed it, you know, it was really cool to see all of those pictures. And I know that doesn't he have like a facility in Nashville with some collection stuff?
I think his facility's down in Mississippi.
I was going to say, does he have two? Yes. Is everything in Mississippi?
Yeah, because they're working on that museum, the Congress of Country Music right now.
Yeah, he's in the planning stages of the Congress of Country Music, which will house all of these, house an exhibit. Yeah. Not only the artifacts we have on loan from him now, but also the rest of his collection. So it's on its way. So.
Well, I mean, and he's such a historian, and we'll talk a little bit more about Marty in a minute, but let's take a quick song break. And you picked a couple of songs for us, Nan. So let's start with your first song, your Graham Parsons song, and tell us why you picked it, and then we'll have a listen.
All right. Well, as part of the exhibit, we have Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris's hats on display. And when Marty was playing with Lester's band in the 1970s, they played a show at Michigan State. I think it was 1973. And Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris opened, and then Lester Flatt and his band followed. But the hearing Parsons play just had such an effect on Marty. And he said to Lester Flatt that night, said, "This is the kind of music I want to do, the traditional country music with the rock and roll influence, just coming from that traditional bass that Graham Parsons always had." And he wrote, we have on display his date book from that year, and it's open to the page of the concert. And at the bottom of the date book, he put an asterisk and said, "This show changed my life."
Oh,
so
wow.
It really had an effect on Marty and Marty's music. And I don't know if they heard this exact song, but this is my favorite Graham Parsons song, so it's the one I chose to play today.
Yeah, it's a great one. I'm a huge Graham Parsons fan, and I don't know, I have several favorites, but this is a good one. Good choice. So let's give it a listen. This is Return of the Grievous Angel.
Won't you scratch my itch, sweet Annie Ridge, and welcome me back to town? Come out on your porch or step into your parlor, and I'll tell you how it all went down. Out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboy angels, and a good saloon in every single town. Oh, and I remembered something you once told me. And I'll be damned if it did not come true. 20,000 roads I went down, 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 and they all led me straight back home to you. 'Cause I headed west to grow up with the country. Across those prairies with those waves of gray, and I saw my devil, and I saw my deep blue sea, and I thought about a calico bonnet from Cheyenne to Tennessee. We flew straight across that river bridge last night. Switchman waved his lantern goodbye today as we went rolling through. Billboards and truck stops passed by the grievous angel. Now I know just what I have to do. Pick it for me, Jane. About a calico bonnet from Cheyenne to Tennessee. The news I could bring, I met up with a king on his head and an amphetamine crown. Talked about unbuckling that old Bible belt and light it out for some desert town. Out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboy angels. A good saloon in every single town. Oh, but I remembered something you once told me, and I'll be damned if it did not come true.
20,000 roads I went down, 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 and they all led me straight back home to you. All right, so that was Gram Parsons with Return of the Grievous Angel. So I already told Nan this, and I'm not just blowing smoke. Like, she picked two songs that, like, I could have easily picked. So I was really, really happy about the song choices. Good job.
And, you know, this is funny. Nan, I don't know how you felt about it, but our guests often get super stressed when we ask them to pick out song choices. Some of them, yeah. it's like the hardest thing, and they get really, really, like, worried about, have I picked the right songs? And we're like, all that matters is that it's a song that means something to you. That's all we want you to do.
Yeah.
But people get really stressed about it.
Yeah, they freak out.
The song choices.
So we were talking before the break, the music break, about the World of Marty Stewart, the exhibit that you all have on till the end of December. God, I can't believe we're on the first day of December today. That's freaking me out a little bit. But and we talked a little bit about the kind of things that the exhibit covers. did you get to personally go through, how did it come about? Like, is this something that you all approached him about or vice versa? And did you work directly with Marty Stewart and did you get to sort of curate it with him or how did that work?
All right. Well, we actually pitched the idea of an exhibit to Marty, and this was back in 2018 or 2019. And we knew we had not done anything like this in the Tea Museum since we had opened. So, and we knew we wanted to focus on something music related, country music related. So, talked to Marty about doing this, and he was on board and he came to visit and viewed the temporary exhibit space. And the exhibit itself is really Marty's vision. He had an idea of what the story he wanted to tell, how he wanted to lay it out. And we took his words and his vision and just kind of put it on paper and into the exhibit design and flowing through the space that we have. And a big part of the exhibit that he definitely wanted to show was what had influenced him, and specifically what had influenced him with his album, The Pilgrim, which was his concept album that he did. And it's a space that's kind of set up almost like a church when you walk into it in the exhibit space. It's he wanted it kind of in the round and just to be a solemn area, and you hear Johnny Cash's voice coming through, which, you know, Johnny was such an influence on Marty Stewart. And within this Pilgrim section are his big influences on that album. So featured are Hank Williams and Marty Robbins, who Marty Stewart's actually named after Marty Robbins.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's neat.
Johnny Cash, just all these big names in country music, and he has all of these personal artifacts from them. So it's a great part of the exhibit, and I love taking people through it. And I've taken a few music historians and musicians through it, and they're pretty amazed as they walk through the exhibit and they get like seeing this stuff. But then when we hit the Pilgrim section, they are just speechless, just looking at these artifacts and taking it all in. So it's really an interesting part. But back to the original question, it was Marty's vision that we kind of put it onto paper.
I bet just looking at all the things that you had to choose from must have been both really exciting but overwhelming.
Yes, and we did get to make several visits to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to Marty's warehouse there downtown. And he, several visits with him, and then he had pulled artifacts, and we chose the artifacts to put on display from what he had pulled, and just got to see what he has. And we have over 300 artifacts in this exhibit.
Wow.
But it's just a sliver of what he's got in his collection here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That will be in the Congress of Country Music when he opens. But yeah, being able to go through those artifacts and just see what he has, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. That must have been like just like being a kid in a candy shop kind of feeling.
Well, and then
he has a shelf of guitar cases, and you just look at the names on the guitar cases and you see, you know, Rogers, Cash, Pride, George Jones. It's all these wonderful artifacts from these musicians that you just
brought up. I don't know if you could
have pulled
me away from those, from the guitars. I would have been like, I'm staying here.
You're right. We did have a Marty Stewart guitar from the Country Music Hall of Fame.
I said camera, but we did have a guitar.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. All of a sudden when you said that, I was like, hey, wait, we did have a.
Yeah, we had one of the Paisley B benders.
Yes.
That we borrowed from the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
So that was neat to have.
Yeah. I don't know why it just popped into my head, but it did.
Well, and what I was going to say is, out of the stuff you had to pick, like, having to limit it must have been hard. Like, well, I guess we better not take that, you know.
Amazing thing, yeah.
Do you remember anything that you wanted to take, but it just didn't make the cut?
We took most of the stuff that he pulled, but there were a few items that we were like, we don't think we can do it. And one thing we did, one of his influences in this Pilgrim section was Roger McGinn from the Byrds.
Oh, yeah.
And He had a guitar pulled for him, and we ended up taking a jacket and his distinctive glasses, sunglasses they wore, but we did not take the guitar. And when we were putting everything together and getting in, we're like, oh, maybe we should have taken that guitar. But there are still lots and lots of guitars to see on display.
So. Yeah. So how far is Philadelphia from Jackson?
Not quite 2 hours. Okay. So not too bad a drive.
So finally, before we move on to something else, because, I mean, Marty Stewart is such a favorite of us. I mean, he's been at our festival here in Bristol numerous times. He's played at other events here in Bristol, at the Paramount in particular, several times. And when we had that exhibit of his work, we got the chance to have a conversation with him about his life as a photographer and not just as a musician. And so he's definitely a favorite. But when you look back, or when you're looking at the exhibit now, what object really holds the best place in your heart for you, like, or the story, or which object would you want to take? If someone had only one object they could look at, which one would it be for you?
So I think for me, working in this business, you get pretty numb to wonderful artifacts. You see things that just blow other people away. And you're like, whatever. Yeah. But it was when we were in Philadelphia packing up some of the artifacts, I grabbed a shirt, and it was Hank Williams' nudie shirt. And I was folding it up to put it into a box, and it just sort of hit me what was in my hands. And I said to my coworkers around me, y'all, this is Hank Williams' shirt. And they all just kind of laughed at me because it was my museum geek moment.
But,
I think for me, just handling that shirt and packing that shirt up just kind of was what this exhibit's about, just the history of country music there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I think what people don't realize is that sometimes it's something like that that has this obvious, wonderful story behind it. And sometimes you can get so excited about much smaller things that are just like how excited I get if we would ever get a real nipper. I'm obsessed with the nipper dog from Victor and RCA, and it's such a big part of the early records that were made here in Bristol. And
and it's still
determined
being used today.
Yeah, I'm determined to get a real nipper one day.
And we were so close.
We almost had one, and it broke my heart.
So I didn't even want to tell you. I was so close.
Yeah, because I was so excited when I found out about it, and then it fell through for whatever reason, and I really thought I was going to cry.
Someday. So here's a public call out. If anyone has any nipper memorabilia and you're looking for a home, let us know.
Renee will be joyful.
Yeah. Well, and I actually have, so you said your favorite object. What do you feel has the most impact or is the most popular with museum patrons?
I think it just kind of depends on the patron. One thing that people really get blown away by is we have A.P. Carter's guitar. And
we're blown away by that.
Yeah.
And jealous.
That's pretty amazing. We have a suit that Jimmy Rogers wore, complete with this straw hat and everything, as well as his guitar case. It says the Singing Brakeman. So these early artifacts, I think, are the ones that just really speak to people.
Yeah,
just having like the access that, you know, Marty's had to collect that stuff and then having access to that stuff is just a really, really amazing opportunity, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, and think about like moving beyond the Marty Stewart exhibit for a minute, because I know we could probably talk about this for much longer, but, in your position, you know, you've got the two museums as the director of collections. What are some of the objects in your collections that are really significant for Mississippi history that you could tell us about?
Some of the objects in our collection?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So not in the Marty Stewart, but in your actual collection, your permanent collection.
General collection. We've got really an amazing collection that focuses on all aspects of historical Mississippi. So not archaeology, but just forward. Great early artifacts. We've got a rare 20-star flag from 1818. Mississippi was the 20th state admitted to the Union. So this was the flag of the United States for 1 year.
Oh, wow. That is cool.
Before Illinois became a state. So it's rare to have this. And we've got that great flag on display. We've got on up into the civil rights, we've got a lot of personal artifacts of Medgar Evers, who was field secretary for the NAACP office here and was assassinated in his driveway in Jackson. And we have the items that were in his desk drawer in the NAACP office, and they're very meaningful. It's his camera, it's his film rolls, even just little things like Tylenol, you know, that was in there, things like that. Just these personal artifacts from extraordinary Mississippians that been held onto.
Well, and, you know, we were just joking about the Nipper, but, you know,
that wasn't a joke.
I mean, it wasn't a joke, but we were laughing while we said it. But, you know, there's always these things that are the things that as a museum that you're looking for in particular, because they tell your story. I mean, for us, you know, we're always looking for things that tell the story of the 1927 Bristol Sessions and the people who played here and who made history here. What is something that's not in your collection that you would love to see represented?
Yeah, tell us about your wish list or your Christmas list for
Santa.
Yeah,
Our Christmas list for anyone who's out there listening. We would love to have like more early artifacts, like especially territorial and early statehood, late 1700, early 1800 artifacts. We have a few from that time period, but not just a ton. That would be a definite gap in our collection. And also civil rights related artifacts, which are harder to find than you might think. And we've got a lot of wonderful things on display in the Civil Rights Museum, but we're always looking for more civil rights related artifacts.
Well, and like you said, I mean, Mississippi was ground zero, you know, for that. So, yeah, that's something to be on the lookout for. If we see anything, we'll definitely let you know. And also, and to go back to the Marty Stewart exhibit, just because, you know, I'm the programming manager and I'm just way into programming. What sort of programming did you all do around the exhibit? Did Marty play or do any lecturing or anything like that? And what other sorts of things?
Yeah, Marty did play for the opening night of the exhibit, or the day before the opening night of the exhibit. It was a great event, and he was wonderful, of course. We have a wonderful book that goes along with it, too, the World of Marty Stewart book, features all the artifacts in it. I think my favorite program that we did, though, was a couple of months ago. It was a Women in Country Music program to go along with the exhibit, and we featured some Mississippi artists. One is Hannah Everhart, which is an up-and-coming local musician, and then also Track 45, which is they're from Meridian, Mississippi. It's a sibling trio, and they're based out of Nashville now. But they interviewed the two sisters, and then the trio got up and played, and they just blew me away. They were fantastic. I'd never heard of them before, so I was glad to get to listen to their music and really expect big things out of them.
We should tell our festival people about them.
Oh, yeah.
They might.
Yeah.
They probably already know about them. They know. But, yeah. But we're working on an exhibit right now that's going to open up in March of next year on women and old-time music. So we might want to talk to you a little bit more behind the scenes about what else happened with that program.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I guess...
we're nearing the end of our show almost.
Yeah, we're getting low on time, but we have a little bit of time left. So before Renee tells us about all of our upcoming events and we play your last song, is there anything that you would like to add that we didn't get to, or anything to plug for yourself or the MDAH? And I know that, I don't know if we mentioned it, but the exhibit is coming to an end soon. So,
right. The exhibit, World of Marty Stewart exhibit, will run through December 31st. So if you get to Jackson before then, do come see the exhibit. Starting in April 1st, we'll have an exhibit opening on Emmett Till. And then July 1st, we're going to have bring in a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian Sites program on the Poor People's Campaign of 1968. So that will be good, too.
That looks like a great exhibit.
Yeah.
That's one that I'd like to bring here one day.
Yeah, we've had a few sites.
We're looking forward to that.
And they're always great. So,
are you guys a Smithsonian affiliate?
We are, yes.
Okay,
are.
So are we. So we. I didn't realize that. So
yeah, I didn't either.
We're sister affiliates.
Yeah, I didn't make that connection either. That's cool.
And going back to the one on Emmett Till, is that one that you all are curating in-house?
It's a traveling exhibit as well. It's coming from the Indianapolis Children's Museum.
Okay.
It will run for, I think, about 6 or 8 weeks.
And, I mean, that's such a hard but powerful story. And I know they recently, the movie about it has come out recently, which right. I've heard is a hard but important thing
sure
to watch.
I was actually going to ask. I hadn't heard any feedback on it, and I hadn't seen it yet. But I can only imagine it is, tough but definitely important.
Yeah.
So I'll watch it sometime soon.
Yeah, we had a civil rights exhibit that was being an NEH on the Road exhibit that was here in 2018, and there was a section of the exhibit about Emmett Till, and it was really interesting when we were talking with children about it, and how insightful they could be on such a hard thing, and something that some of them hadn't heard of before too, which boggles the mind really. But so that was, I can imagine that's going to be an exhibit to remember and to really learn from.
Yeah, we should make our road trip sooner than we expected.
Yes. Yeah.
It'll probably be warmer down there too this year. But
it's always going to be warmer down there than here.
Well, so Renee, do you want to tell us about some of our upcoming events?
Yes, before we jump into the next song, which I know is also a favorite of yours, Scotty. So.
That song, I'll tell you a little tidbit about it. It's one of the first songs I really remember. When did it come out? Like 85 or something?
For those who don't know what we're talking about, it's called The Highwayman.
Oh, yeah, The Highwayman. I have like this very vivid memory of listening to it in my dad's pickup truck riding around. Like, that's what we did when I was a kid, was ride around in his pickup and listen to
isn't that what all kids did in the back with no way to stay
much,
in the truck
yeah.
when you wreck?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much.
Children of the 70s and 80s.
But out of all of the music that we listened to, I remember that song just, it was one of those moments that it just gave me chills and just stuck with me from the get-go. But go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, we'll have a listen to that in a second. But before we move on to the song and we say goodbye to Nan, there are some things still coming up at the museum and with the radio station over the next few weeks. This weekend on December 3rd, we have our Bluegrass Jam. Usually that is the fourth Saturday of the month, but the fourth Saturday of the month was right around the Thanksgiving holiday, and then in November, and then the fourth Saturday of the month in December is right around the Christmas holiday, so we actually moved that to this Saturday. So we have a combined November and December jam on December 3rd for the Bluegrass Jammers, and then on November 3rd? Or
I meant
whatever I said, it should be December 3rd. And on December 10th, we will have our regular second Saturday of the month community jam. So you'll still get to jam twice this month, but the Bluegrass is just on a different date than usual. Then on December 8th, that's next week, on Thursday, we have our Farm and Fun Time show. The last of the year, we'll be having Daryl Scott here with us, along with John Long and Bill and the Bells, our house band. That is a sold-out show now, but you can catch it online via Radio Bristol's Facebook Live page, or also via their YouTube channel. So you can still have a listen to that wonderful show at 7 p.m. on December 8th. And then finally, on December 13th, we also have our last speaker series of the year, and we have Santa with us, or the man who has played Santa for 25 years on the Appalachian Santa Train. We'll have Don Royston here with us in person and virtually, so you can, if you're not around, you can listen, you can watch that show from, or that speaker series from your home in your pajamas with your sugar cookies and your hot cocoa to get in the mood. But he will be talking to us about the importance of the Appalachian Santa Train, the history of that wonderful program to share funds and to share Christmas gifts and Christmas food with people in Appalachia, from down in Tennessee all the way up to Pennsylvania, and also his time as playing the Santa on that train. And I believe Marty Stewart's been involved with the Santa train a few times.
Probably. I mean, he told me about a lot of country musicians, especially that have been on it.
I'm pretty sure Marty Stewart has had a connection to the Santa train too. So just another connection with you, Nan, and the work that you all have done there. So that's what's going on. And then obviously, we'll be taking a little break over the holidays and back in January with loads going on.
Yeah, back at it then. Well, first, Nan, I just want to say thank you very much.
Yeah, we've loved having you on here. It's been a great and interesting show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was good talking to you. And so we already spoiled the song, but tell
us. We didn't. Scotty did.
Sorry. but yeah, tell us why you chose this song and about the people who are involved.
All right. Well, like you, Scotty, I've always loved this song. And it's The Highwaymen, which is recorded by The Highwaymen. The super group is Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson and Chris Christopherson. And Marty Stewart actually encouraged them to record this song, The Highwaymen. And from that, they took their name. And included in our exhibit is the gold record for the song that they presented to Marty when they got the gold record. So it's on display now.
Well, and one more thing is I've always had a dream to get three other people and to do this song at karaoke. That makes it sound like I'm a big karaoke guy, but I mean, I'll do it if it's there, I guess. But I just think it would be so much fun. But I don't know which part I would choose. Whose part would you choose, Nan?
I don't know. Probably Johnny Cash's.
Yeah, I mean, that's the go-to. And I like the Willie Nelson one, too. But I really like... I don't remember. There's no point.
But this is definitely a good song choice, and I'm glad it's cool that it also has that Marty Stewart connection, which I didn't know about. So
yeah, I didn't know until
I love to hear those kind of stories. So that's very cool. So yeah, I will reiterate what Scotty said. Thanks for being with us, and for anyone who's listening and is down around Jackson, be sure and check out the two museums, but also. If you're there before the end of December, you should definitely check out The World of Marty Stewart. And I might have to go online. Can you order the book online? Because I would love to have a copy of that.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. That's a great book.
Yeah.
Well, here is The Highwaymen, and we'll be back next week.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive. I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico. I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they said that I got killed. But I'm living still. I was a dam builder across a river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. A place called Boulder on the Wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound. But I'm still around. I'll always be around, around, and around, and around, and around, and around. I fly a starship across the universe divide. And when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again. Or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I will remain. I'll be back again and again.